Good morning, everyone. I apologise for being a bit late. We rang the taxi, but it was late, and then well, I suppose what you call is Canberra traffic, which isn't like Brisbane traffic, but so I apologise for being late. Before I start today, I do want to acknowledge that we are on Ngunnawal land, and I acknowledge the traditional landowners of this area, such beautiful country, and the welcome to country that Mrs. Ruth Bell gave us yesterday here was quite warming, and I know as a non-Indigenous person it's very important for me and for me as a white fella to encourage other white fellas to keep that in the forefront of our mind, that we are on Aboriginal land, we are on stolen land, and we need to respect that and respect the traditional owners, first owners of the land. I also want to thank Ara and, where'd she go, over there, in white today. Very virginal, and thank you for inviting me to speak and act cross. I too also want to acknowledge my sisters, Jackie, who's here, and thanks for your speech yesterday, Jackie, about governance, leadership and healing. It's really important, three principles that all of us need to embrace for a better country for all of us, black and white. And acknowledge other Aboriginal people who are here in the audience this morning. I also want to acknowledge my sisters who've been in prison and who have the lived prison experience, as well as any men here, and of course the families and friends of people who have been in prison, are in prison, or may be in prison and criminalised in the very near future. Soon we're having a wonderful new prison built here. Aren't we all excited? I had a look on the internet the other day because I actually sent the name of my speech to here. I don't know what happened. There was a different name put up on the website, and so I sort of gauged my speech to that, which wasn't my original heading. But I noticed in the program it's actually the right heading. But I am going to go with the heading that was on the internet initially, and that was, the slight change that was on the internet, and the program read, "The Impact of Prison and the Case for Change in Correctional Facilities." Oh, Jesus. That wouldn't be a title that I'd pick in a blue fit, but anyway, very creative. While I'm happy to talk about the impact of prisons until the cows come home, and many of you might already have heard me do that, things happening here in the ACT and elsewhere in the world have forced me to drastically alter the second part of the title, and that is the case for change. I cannot in all consciousness, stand here before you and talk about the case for change in prisons. Change is not what is needed in prisons. We've been told for years, decades actually, about changes in prison, about the more enlightened view of authorities who build and maintain them and make money on the backs of misery of people held in them. And what we have as a result of that is more prisons, more women as well as men in prison, more and worse human rights abuses and systemic discriminations of women in prison. More of the prison industrial complex, which sees government and the private sector gain financially with each new prison that is built. And that's going to happen here, and I imagine already happening. We see more people with mental illness, more Indigenous women in prison, more Indigenous men. We see more women incarcerated on charges based on the criminalisation of social policy, a result of the criminalisation of poverty, disadvantage, homelessness, mental health, youth, and it goes on. I can't stand here in the ACT where the so-called human rights prison has just been given the right to strip search prisoners, one of the most abusive and intrusive treatments perpetrated against women and men in prison, and then talk about change. I can't stand here and talk about change when one of your women died in the hands of the law enforcement agency, being corrective services of this territory. And why? Because she was mentally unwell. Tanya Liliosis. I hope I pronounced her name right. I don't know if I have, but I'm going to call her Tanya. And it was reported in the media on the 14th of July here. A Canberra woman, who we know is Tanya, has died more than a week after trying to hang herself with a seatbelt in the back of the ACT Corrective Services van. The unnamed woman, who now we know is Tanya, which I'm adding, because I don't want to call her an unknown woman, 42 years of age, from the Canberra suburb of Fadden, was taken to Calvary Hospital after the incident on Friday, July the 4th. The woman died, Tanya died there, on Saturday afternoon. And they go on. The woman, who reportedly has a history of psychiatric problems and suicide attempts, was taken into custody for allegedly breaching a protection order. Another report on the 9th of July said that police had taken Tanya to the Canberra Hospital psychiatric unit twice in 2 days before the incident had earlier, before the incident, after earlier suicide attempts, but she was sent away on each occasion after she was assessed as not being admitted to the hospital. They go on. She tried to hang herself during a 15-minute drive to the remand centre. The two officers in the van did not realise until they arrived. Although officers resuscitated her, she had already suffered significant brain damage. And we know that another woman was in the van who witnessed this and is severely traumatised by Tanya's death at the hands of your corrective services enforcement agency. I suppose at this point I do want to ask us to have a minute's silence for Tanya's life. And while you're thinking of Tanya, I have to say to you all today that you'll need to brace yourself, because this is going to be the first of many at the hands of corrective services and law enforcement agencies with the opening of a new prison in your wonderful territory. I have to stand here before you as an abolitionist, as someone who believes no change in prisons can produce a positive result, as someone who believes that prisons don't work and that one day, like slavery, the long-term incarceration of men, women and children will be seen as a grave error, a terrible experiment in social policy that produced the reverse of what it was intended. Just like circus or zoo animals, really, men, women and children don't learn or gain anything from being caged. The reverse, they lose their very essence, their hearts. It stumps me that in a world where open zoos now are the norm, where old traditional circuses no longer keep animals, where creatures from domestic pets to chooks to pigs are usually given free range, that in this world we still think of locking up people will make them better. To me, it defies logic. To me, the words prison and human rights are contradictions in terms. The two words oppose each other, like stop, go, yes, no, good and bad. Prisons, by their very existence, deny just about every basic human right we have. And their very existence validates an ideology that is rampant around the world right now. The ideology sees the most disadvantaged, the most abused, the most deprived, re-brutalised, further disadvantaged and more deprived. Prisons underscore the social, political, economic and judicial system that we have all created to keep our own advantage heads above water. They ensure there is always someone else to blame. They ensure there is always someone to punish on behalf of us all. Don't ever tell me that a young, addicted Aboriginal woman who steals or a woman who has a mental illness who sleeps rough under a bridge or in a park acts purely in a vacuum of their own making or choosing. Don't ever tell me that the slums, the ghettos, the often violent and disadvantaged suburbs of any of our major cities around the world were the dream destinations of the children who grew up to call these places home. And don't tell me poverty, abuse, mental illness and addiction and homelessness were actively chosen by the little girls and little boys who grew up to be the men and women now living and dying behind the steel bars of prisons. And the extension of that is when they're released, because of the trauma suffered inside. Don't tell me a life of urban grief and sickness, of loneliness and despair and marginalisation were actively chosen by the little Indigenous kids of this country who now, as adults, people our streets, our prisons and our watchhouses. They did not choose them. And you know what? We are all responsible, each and every one of us. We, the advantage, the money, the well, are kept in our safe places by the very fact that others are carrying our collective blame for the ills of society and of the world. And it's not a comfortable thought. Of course, most of us do what we can to avoid it. We do that by making these people, the others, invisible, and by semantics. We label them. They are bad, they're lazy, they're weak, they're violent. They're murderers, they're rapists, they're thieves, they're black, We make them less through these labels than human. And then the reverse, to market their incarceration and their human rights abuses they experience every day by calling prisons human rights prisons. We're in lines with European Union, human rights charters. You know, they're campuses, they're not prisons. They're correctional centres, we're correcting them. In that way, we can all get up in the morning and go about our days really without weeping, I have to say, without giving much thought as to what's going on behind the bars, those nice looking buildings. They look so flash, of course, everything inside must be happening real flash. And I suppose I've never been able to do that because I have personally lived amongst the others. I lived much of my adolescent in juvenile detention and several years behind the bars and bricks and wire at Boggo Road Prison in Queensland. And since then, I've chosen to stay amongst the others and fight for their rights with them and their dignity with them to the organisation that grew from my prison experience, Sisters Inside. Sisters Inside provides services to women in prison and advocates for their human rights. Recently, this work has been bearing fruit in the form of a new spotlight on the lives of women in prison and the conditions they endure. It has come in the form of many responses across the country, but especially by the Queensland Anti-Discrimination Commission, to a complaint made by Sisters Inside about what we see as systemic discrimination against women in prison and human rights breaches, along with similar complaints in other states and territories, in New South Wales and Victoria, and more recently, a report tabled in Northern Territory. As we see it, the resulting reports vindicate the work not only our organisation, but all those who fight with us and for women inside, just as these women sitting in the front here do in ACT. And I congratulate you on your courage and your work. It takes a lot of guts to go through prison and stand up. The reports all urge the state government and territory governments, for that matter, to address such issues as mandatory strip searching, which we now have a nice piece of legislation here in the ACT. Surprise, surprise. The deleterious effects on the children of incarcerated mothers, the terrible plight of women with mental illness, as well as that of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, of course, the overrepresentation of Aboriginal women, and the ludicrous claims made on behalf of prisons by those who build and run them, that is, that they actually work. That women who commit crimes need to be locked up, dehumanised, degraded, further deprived, that they will be made into better people in prison, and that they will emerge better equipped with training and resources and life skills and work experience and be rehabilitated. Many here of you will know that 60% of women who serve a prison sentence will return to prison again, and 88% of Aboriginal women will return to prison again in this country. If my mathematics is right, that is an extremely high failure rate. It's not seen as a failure out of corrective services. Maybe I'm wrong and my maths are a bit out. I don't know. The claims laid on behalf of prisons are blatantly false. And if any other government institution or organisation, ACTCOS for that, or any organisation that you work on in the community sector, recorded that kind of failure rate, 60 to 88%, you would be defunded, your management committee would probably be sacked, you'd be disbanded, you'd be restructured, you'd be, gutted. Many things would happen. But what do we do? Top up more of our taxpayers' money into prisons and corrections. The truth is that prison repeats all the experience of abuse and deprivation and humiliation that most women who go inside have experienced their whole lives. In fact, to the great majority of women in prison, the term human rights is a contradiction. Their human rights have been compromised well before they ever hit the criminal justice system. And prior to going to prison, I'm not sure if you know, 98% of women have experienced physical abuse. 89% have experienced sexual abuse or assault before they hit the gates. And a great many of them have experienced poverty in families that are dysfunctional, abusive, in which they're not valued. The effects of poverty and abuse mean most have a low level of education, low levels of self-esteem and few skills. The attempts that many make to self-medicate, to deal with the pain of life, mean a great proportion have addictions to drugs and or alcohol. Their health is characteristically poorer and many have mental health issues that have not been addressed. In the past few years, we have seen abundant and heartbreaking evidence of that. And prisons have become the de facto psychiatric institutions of our communities, where behaviours are not treated but punished, where people are not just chemically restrained but physically restrained and abused, And a high proportion of incarcerated women are, of course, Aboriginal. And for them, all of these things are multiplied. Multiplied, exacerbated, and getting worse all the time. Some women are from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and for them, these things are also multiplied. So when we talk about human rights of women in prison, we are talking about a very delicate thing indeed. It's a notion, actually, that most of these women have given up on, really. Human rights are things other people have. Life and the experience of being a prisoner does that to you. But these are not just rhetorical statements conjured up by Sisters Inside or other groups like the ones gathered here. These recent inquiries by the Anti-Discrimination Commission bodies and the Ombudsman in Northern Territory concluded that we are right. The conditions we talk about in prison, the numbers of women and men in prison, the lack of human rights are real and are doing real damage, not just to women, but to whole families and into our communities. In Queensland, after complaints by Sisters Inside, the Anti-Discrimination Commission urged the state government to address such issues as mandatory strip searching, the shocking effects on children of incarcerated mothers, the terrible plight of women with mental illness, the racism and abuse that Aboriginal women experience daily at the hands of corrections, and the ludicrous classification system that controls women's movements inside prison and on release. In the Northern Territory, the Ombudsman has recently investigated complaints from women prisoners in Northern Territory prisons and made a raft of recommendations, 67 in fact, about education, rehabilitation programs, the use of restraint, solitary confinement, the treatment of Aboriginal prisoners, employment, pre- and post-release, treatment of prisoners with mental illness or cognitive disabilities, and the importance of contact for women and their children. The report found that in Northern Territory, the imprisonment of Aboriginal women was double the Australian rate in 2005-2006. A staggering 81% of women prisoners were Aboriginal women. 87% of these Aboriginal women were victims of sexual and emotional abuse of children. 74% experienced sexual and emotional abuse as adults. 26% of the Aboriginal women were wards of the state as children. 51% had previous mental health diagnosis. 52% had attempted suicide. 58% had never received any assistance to deal with this abuse. And it goes on. 80% reported using drugs and or alcohol. 86% were biological mothers. Almost all were unemployed at the time they were imprisoned. Almost half were not receiving Centrelink payments. They had no income. 43% with dependent children had no income at all. No income at all. And what I want to do, I just want to go to these two reports because I think it's important that women's stories are told and not just statistics trumped out. I want to, the Queensland Anti-Discrimination Commission, this is a report here, described where women are kept in prison in Queensland who have a mental illness. They're called crisis support units. And this is how the commissioner, when she went into the crisis support unit at Brisbane Women's Correctional Centre, described it. In Brisbane Women's Correctional Centre, the crisis support unit consists of a number of segregated cells surrounding a small central common area and an adjoining small caged-in exercise yard. And while I'm describing this to you, this is going to be, you know, the description of your prison inside here. They might flower it up with different language, but this is actually how someone independent will describe what's going to happen in your prison and what it looks like. The unit has a padded cell with restraining devices. The cell contains very little, a bed with a suicide-proof mattress, and no personal property of any kind is allowed. The lights in the cells are on 24 hours a day, and while they're in the cells, women wear a suicide gown. Suicide gowns are loose cotton garments, similar to the gowns worn in operating theatres. They have fastenings down the back, which routinely gape, and provide little allowance for modesty or dignity, as no underclothes are allowed to be worn beneath the gowns. Women who are detained in a padded cell in the crisis support unit are generally held in a totally naked state. Women are not permitted to use tampons while in the CSU. Occasionally, women may be able to attend programs and employment. In other situations, they may be confined for significant periods of time and only exit the unit for a shower and exercise. While the prisoner has contact with corrective services officers, she may have limited or no access to other inmates for support or friendship. Each time a woman exits and re-enters her cell, she is strip-searched. This occurs 10 to 12 times a day. And it goes on. Most recent report, table, Northern Territory Parliament, 2008. We've been making complaints across every jurisdiction in the country around the abuses of human rights of women in prison, and that depended on the legislation in those jurisdictions. And what had actually happened was the anti-discrimination legislation in Northern Territory didn't allow the anti-discrimination commissioner to undertake a review in his legislation. He could only take individual complaints, so he couldn't do a systemic review of human rights or discrimination abuses. So the women sent their complaints to the Ombudsman, and the Ombudsman, in her great wisdom, undertook a report, Carolyn Richards, and this was tabled the 11th of April. She signed off the 11th of April 2008. And I want to tell you about Sue. Sue was in Darwin Correctional Centre. I don't know if people are aware of the prison at Darwin for women. It was built in the 70s as basically outhouse concrete cells for overflow of watch house for men. So they're very, probably from where Janet and I are, that's how wide the cells are to the back wall. So they're very tiny, they have no windows, and then there's demountables out the back. So it's very small, old, and there's one cell there with a cage out the front of it. And when I was there working with the women up in Darwin, there was an elderly Aboriginal woman there who they continued to hose, who obviously had serious mental health problems. But they said she needed to be hosed because she was dirty and wouldn't look after her personal hygiene, which is actually part of her mental illness. And they did that in front of me without battering an eyelid. Now, whether women get hosed in your new human rights prison, we'll wait and see. Anyway, in regards to Sue's attempted suicide, an Aboriginal woman, 18 documents were reviewed. The Ombudsman reports, she goes on to say, Sue attempted suicide by cutting at around 9:30 a.m. on the 5th of June. She was transported to the Royal Darwin Hospital for the night where she underwent surgery. At 1 p.m. the next day, she returned to prison. She was taken to the prison doctor who declared her at risk, and she was placed in B block, cell 6, under observation. That afternoon, Sue opened the wound in her wrist and she was returned to hospital, where she was assessed by the forensic mental health for admittance to the psychiatric unit there. The assessment concluded that she did not meet the criteria for admittance, and she was therefore discharged and returned to the prison the same night, the 6th of June. The chief prison officer liaised with the prison doctor regarding Sue's management. She was placed again in B block, cell 6, where she was shackled to the bed overnight. The officer was stationed outside the cell for direct observation at 15-minute intervals. Sue remained in B block, cell 6, each night on observation until her release from prison on the 14th of June. During each day, she was conveyed to J block. On the 13th of June, the day before her release, she again attempted suicide while on observation in B block. Officers physically intervened and stopped her. The decision was taken to again shackle Sue to the bed and place a motorcycle helmet on her head, in addition to her being medicated. After 2 to 3 hours, the shackles were removed. Sue was released the next morning. The visiting medical officer provided some additional information to the Ombudsman in relation to the treatment around women like Sue who have borderline personality disorder, which is like, the high proportion of women in any prison in the Western world will have mental health problems and usually diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And that's because of serious abuse, systemic abuse they've experienced, sexual and physical, as children. And the visiting medical officer, the information he provided in regards to the nature of borderline personality disorder, he said it's common in young females, especially those who have been sexually abused, and is typified by manipulation, self-harm episodes, eating disorders, and sometimes accidental suicide. The cutting behaviours performed with the primary intent to manipulate and the act of cutting will often lead to de-escalation of the tension that caused the cutting. The condition is highly resistant to treatment and usually improves as lifestyle conditions improve rather than after any particular psychiatric therapy. So this is why, in their justification, women are turned away from mental health facilities time and time again, because they're borderline and really they're just doing this for manipulation, they have self-harm episodes, you know, and sometimes accidentally kill themselves. In regards to the matters arising for Sue in solitary confinement, the report goes on to say, isolation was not only the immediate response, but it remained the overriding theory for the next 9 days, right up to her release. Furthermore, the isolation took place away from familiar environment and in a men's maximum security block. Social support was by no means non-existent, but it was limited. The at-risk observation file reported that on the 11th of June, 6 days after her first suicide attempt, Sue received a visit from another prisoner and was permitted to make a telephone call to her daughter. She also received a one-hour visit from her mother and other family members that same day. The file makes no other mention of any other contact with support people over the 9 days. There's no mention of any contact from the welfare officer, Indigenous support worker or prison rehabilitation team. There was no record on the file of any counselling being provided. Then we go on, where the Ombuds have looked at the use of restraint, cell B6. An additional matter of concern in the above account is the use of bodily restraints on the 6th and the 13th of June. On both dates, Sue was shackled to the bed via handcuffs on both arms, securing her to metal rings attached to the wall and bed base of the cell. On June 6th, this restraint was in place from 10:15 to 9:34 a.m. 10:15 p.m, 9:34 a.m. the following morning. 11 hours, 15 minutes. She'd been shackled like that to the wall. On the 13th of June, it was in place for 2 hours in the evening, and in the case on the 13th of June, the mattress had first been removed before Sue was secured to the concrete bed base. The above documents do not specify whether this was also the procedure on the 6th of June. Cell B6 is the only cell in Darwin Correctional Centre which has metal rings to allow this type of restraint. The rings have likely been in place since the prison built in 1978. Like the other solitary confinement cells in B block, the cell is small, old, dank, discoloured and concrete with almost no natural light. Metal rings are fixed along the concrete bed base and the wall adjoining the bed. The cell opens into an enclosed open air space with high concrete walls, concrete floor and only the sky visible through a caged roof. It is part of the men's maximum security and remand block constructed in the 1970s. The cell B6 restraint applied to Sue on the 6th and 13th of June and was not listed in the schedule of approved instruments and is not referred anywhere in the directive. So that's all you. Written reports and authorities that corrective services have to comply with. The reason for the use of restraint is in both cases listed in the reporting documents in one word only, self-harm. A restraint belt is mentioned on the 7th of June in context of transport to a medical centre or hospital, but the use of this restraint belt is not mentioned on the prison's restraint file, contrary to the directive. So Sue was also, I don't know if people know what a restraint belt is. It's a belt that goes around your waist with rings where you're shackled, handcuffed, and legs are all connected through chains. On the 14th of June, the Professional Standards Unit compared an investigation report into Sue's attempted suicide for the Deputy CEO, Department of Justice. The report concludes that the correctional centre and medical staff have responded appropriately and followed all required procedures in this incident. The report also makes no mention of the use of restraints. And Superintendent Raby runs the prison and still does. Well, he was till late last year when I was last up there. And he's a man that's worked in the prison system all around Australia for 40 years or so. And so his response to this, he goes on to say, in recent years, it's only recorded as having been applied to two prisoners. This is cell B6. Both of them were women. Both cases of self-harm. as at November 2006, the most recent use of the strait was September 06. Jackie and I were in the prison with the women last year, July 07, and spoke to all the women in the prison. They came and met with us because our conference was there, and they told us quite freely, as one of the women did, that she was over there in the last week. They've been using it. It's an ongoing use. And I actually saw the restraints in the wall myself. By mistake, they showed me around the prison when I first got up there, and I was taken to the men, and by mistake I was taken into the health centre, and the nurses were very nice and took me out the back, and because apparently I didn't know there was a tender out for the health services, and they thought I was there interested in, you know, putting in a tender. And they're going, "Oh, you're here for the tender," and they're showing me the restraints. Oh, we use these restraints in this, you know, old convict style concrete wall. I go, "No, I'm Debbie Kilroy from Sisters Side. Get out of here now." It's like, you know, that, like, she just freaked. But I raise it with the politicians, with the bureaucrats, with corrections, and as far as I'm aware, which we were in there, they were still there, still being used. I suppose my point here is you've got a new prison opening. Don't believe everything that's written down. You're going to have to scratch the surface, really scratch the surface to find out. And you're going to have to believe the women and men and the stories they tell. I know they're horrendous, but this is polished. I'm not even telling you the horror stories, really. This is a day-to-day event. It's scary stuff what happens to people in our prisons in this country. You know, it makes me ashamed. But Superintendent Raby acknowledged that the use of this restraint has not been formally evaluated against the relevant minimum standards or principles of best practice, and that there were no plans to do so. He commented that he was aware of similar equipment in a number of other prisons around Australia. That's Sue's story. Once again, you know, like Sue, as like Tanya here, you know, taken to mental health services, turned away. When they do go back to prison, Tanya died. Sue goes back to prison and she's physically restrained, you know, to the wall and body belts and handcuffs. And then we have Jackie, you know, one of the women in Queensland who was in prison in that crisis support unit that I described in Queensland. And when she was in there, she was restrained and her arm was broken, and they had handcuffs on her for 48 hours until they took her to the hospital because her arm had swelled up. It's only when some medical staff had seen her, they took her to the hospital. Her arm, you know, her wrist was broken clearly. Her arm was put in plaster. When she came back, prison officers deemed that as a weapon, so they cut the plaster off her arm, and then it was broken over and over again every time they tried to restrain her. She was also diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. She was eventually released, and she told me that she had been sexually abused inside the prison and she wanted to make a complaint. So she went to the police and made a complaint, and we have all this on tape. She told the police, and the police officer's basic response was, "You're mentally ill, you were highly medicated, and you're probably delusional. It really didn't happen," and so it wasn't investigated any further. She also did tell the, you know, the commission in evidence when they took evidence from women in Queensland. But Jackie, you know, was seriously distressed, lonely. All she really had was Sisters Inside. She would come to us. You know, they'd taken her son, he was in care. And eventually she was turned away, you know, over and over again from mental health services. She would come to our office. She would try to hang herself. We would get her to the psych unit. She would, you know, I'd sit there. She'd be assessed. And then they'd say, "You're fine. Go home." Where I knew quite well she wasn't fine, that she would continue to try to hang herself. And then March last year, her MO changed. She found on the internet that it would be easier to take her life by burning herself to death. So on three occasions in the week ending the 30th of March, she was transported to the Logan Hospital. I think it was a Monday. She doused herself with petrol. An ambulance was called. She was taken. One of our staff at Sisters, Tilly, went to her home and cleaned it all up so she could come back because she was turned away again. Then the next day, she's back again. She sliced her wrists. But the reports say the cutting wasn't that bad, so she really wasn't that suicidal. This is attention-seeking. She's sent away again. She's taken back again the next day, and the police ring me when she's in the ambulance, saying that she's on the way, that she's doused herself again. saying you need to keep her in the psych unit. You've got to actually keep her. This is serious from our experience. The MO's changed and she's more distressed and it's happening more frequently. And they're going, they couldn't do anything. You know, hospital staff ring us and say, you better come and get her, we're releasing her again. So I rung the director of mental health in Queensland Health and said to him, you need to actually keep her in there, she is going to die. But by the time he's rung, she's already released. She shows up Friday afternoon, 30th of March, at Sisters Inside. A man knocks on the door, one of our Indigenous staff answers it. He said, Jackie's down the back, she's got a tin of petrol. Donsky goes down. She's yelling out him to F off. Donsky said, you better just go. Donsky's walking towards her down the back out of the office, saying, what are you doing, Jackie? And she's poured the petrol all over herself. Donsky's trying to have a conversation with her and she's flicking a lighter. The lighter ignited. She goes up. She fanned it, freaked out, ran, and her whole body was engulfed. And Donna tried to put her out, ripped her own clothes off. And you can imagine the flames were metres high, a human body on fire, screaming, help me, help me, help me. Other staff ran, tried to get the hoses. We all know water won't put petrol out. The man next door in an industrial, he came over with, we had one of those small fire blankets and a fire extinguisher. Got the flames out eventually. She was on fire for 4 minutes. Donsky still said, you know, she's been quite traumatised, obviously, by this. But, you know, like it was like her neck and in certain parts, the back, lower back and the back of her neck were still smouldering like coals on a fire trying to go out. And she's screaming that she can't breathe, and that's because, you know, her body, Donsky, you know, she described, she washed her feet melt away, her hands, her face, her whole body changed in colour. And then the ambulance finally gets there. And, you know, Donsky's saying the ambulance is here. And she did not want to go with them. She still didn't want to go to hospital, because that's the thing with people with mental health problems. They need some support, but they don't want to be confined. And she tried to get up and run. And it's only that, you know, Donsky was running around in underwear and had to go find some clothes and then come back and sat with Jackie to say, they're going to look after you, I'll stay with you. And we did stay with her for 11 days until they finally let her die because they kept her alive. And I mean, she had an opportunity, you know, when I say to say goodbye to her son, you know, more in spirit because she was unconscious for those 11 days. And, you know, I found out then that I was basically down as next of kin and had to make some serious choices about her life. And myself and Helen Connor, who's the Executive Director of Australian Mental Health Consumer Network, sat with Jackie when they basically, you know, put enough drugs in her system to let her die peacefully, and that was on the 11th of April. Now, this is another woman turned away, turned away, turned away. Her trauma, her child, the trauma of Sisters Inside staff, all of us, who, you know, and those who tried to put her out. You know, like we all get traumatised by what happens to women and men who are mentally unwell. But we have a system that turns them away, but the system that does accept them is prison, and it actually creates more trauma for them than ever before. You know, I just want you need to listen to these stories to understand and maybe go just that extra inch for these men and women in your community. Because these are the stories that are going to be very familiar to you day in, day out, when this prison opens. Under the banner of human rights. So, you know, people talk about reforming the system that incarcerates them. Why? To make who feel better, really. I know it doesn't make me feel any better. You know, does it make you feel better when you think you're reforming, tinkering with the edges of a system that's a fundamental failure? You know, I'm going to put to you today that decarceration is the first option in regards to the movement towards abolition. The first option, when we talk about women, you know, not prison reform, not tinkering around the edges with a system that is and has always failed them, and not change. And I want to remind you how it fails them, as I've described in what happens in prison and women's stories. And look, let's look at, you know, an Aboriginal woman who's a primary carer of children. And, you know, they're the majority in our prison system who are imprisoned, usually, what women are imprisoned for theft, drug use or fraud because of poverty. They're the majority of offences that women are imprisoned for. Imprisonment means, firstly, that she loses her children. She may lose her relationship, her family, certainly a job if she had one. In Northern Territory, you don't even get Centrelink, really, half of them. She'll lose her home, certainly her self-esteem and emotional well-being. And that's just for starters, inside. Any illusions about rehabilitation are soon demolished. If she's got a mental illness or living with the aftermath of abuse or drug use, what help can she expect? If she's got no education or training, will the system provide this? Well, in Queensland, they provide it to 10. How many are they going to provide it for in ACT prison? That's the question I'd want to know the answer to. If she wants to maintain some healthy contact with her children, how's that going to happen here in ACT? How many visits are they going to happen? Is she going to be strip searched before and after? I would say yes with your new legislation pushed through, the changes to the Act. And who will she ask to bring her children to see her? Who's going to do that when most of them are the care of child protection agencies and they say they're under-resourced? Children will miss out on seeing their children, women will miss out on seeing the children, and it will be used as a carrot and stick inside. You misbehave or you don't do this, you're not going to see your child. Who's going to be the watch outside? Once she's released, how does she take her shame, her shattered relationships, her lack of a job, income or any kind, her absent children and invisible friends, and make a new life? You know, that stuff about invisible friends, speaking at a feminist conference just 2 days ago, and we were talking about, you would have heard, the Chief Magistrate of Queensland, Di Finkelton, went to prison a couple of years ago now. Well, after her release, when the High Court overturned her conviction and sentence, there was a big party for Di. There was 500 people at that party for her release. The women that we pick up, that is all they have, them and their garbage bag. They don't have any friends. They have sisters inside as an organisation. Imagine if every woman, I'm not saying could come out, and every man could come out of prison that maybe not had 500 friends like Di did, or the big party that Pauline Hanson had. Sorry, forgot her name. But, you know, even 10, even 5 people supports. You know, I've got where I am from my prison experience because of the family and friends around me, as other men and women do. You can't do it in isolation. You can't do it when you've got no connection to community. Who's going to do that for the people in your community that you're locking up, give a mandate to lock up and be brutalised like this in your prison system? How does she get her kids back from the department? How does she get a house, food, even a fridge to put the food in, a job and the strength to make the changes she needs to? She's been stripped of all the wherewithal to do what the system wants and expects, you know, which is the expectation to turn herself into a model citizen, whatever that means. I still don't know what that means, really. You know, incarceration's got to be the first option for women, and for that matter for men in prison, for non-violent offences. You know, but one of our enormous problems is the fear-mongering from politicians and others about crime. The media has a big part. You know, for example, in Queensland, the police minister, who is also our corrections minister, is now pushing the argument, and the media drives it, that Aboriginal women are more violent than anyone else. You know, and that more women in general are committing violent crime than ever before. You know, I don't know if you've had that media ramp through here, that young women are becoming more violent. They're the ones to be scared of now, especially black young women. Well, I need to say, you know, when you scratch the surface and have a look at the statistics about what women, the violent crimes women have been charged with, it's usually retaliation because of domestic violence. And then we put in laws to supposedly protect women from domestic and family violence. Well, what happens? Police are called to the house. Not only the men criminalised, but the women are taken away. We saw a 9% increase of Aboriginal women in our Queensland prisons when that domestic violence family violence legislation was introduced and acted, because Aboriginal women were arrested as well. So we've got to scratch the surface about what are violent crimes, not just take the data from the ABS or, you know, your justice systems here, your governments. What is it defined? What does it say? Even around when I gave you the rehabilitation rates, you know, the officials will come back and say, well, Debbie Kilroy's telling you tales. It's really not 60% and 80%, because if you look at the Productivity Commission's report, it says 37%, 38%. But let's have a look in the little tiny footnote down the bottom about how they count recidivism. And here, you know, and the media probably will report that you've got a lower rate of recidivism. How they report it is they take it from today's date 2 years on. So if I'm in prison today and I get out, I don't come back, there's no recidivism. But they don't count the 60, 100, however many women on today that have been in before. So it's like a clean skin count. Do you know what I mean? So it's actually not a real count. So let's do the real numbers so we really know how the system's failing, so we can actually abolish it and think outside of the bars for a better community. And, you know, we've got to think about what constitutes a crime these days. With our new laws in Queensland, homelessness is a crime, you know, as is a failure to move on by a directive of a police officer or having $2. You know, if you don't have $2 in your possession, it's a crime. And now, as of, you know, this bill passed, you know, last week or the week before, here, if you don't comply with your strip search, you'll be criminalised inside, you know. Remembering, though, still a human rights prison, OK? Don't fool yourselves. Sister Sai believes that these laws and prison further abuse the abuse, further disadvantages the disadvantaged, further impoverishes the poor, further deprives those born to deprivation. We lock women up for the behaviours they have adopted to survive poverty, abuse and disabilities and racism. We tell them we must stop these behaviours. We lock them up and repeat the abuse they have suffered all their lives. Then we release them to the streets in a worse position and a worse state than before, and tell them that they are in charge of their own destinies. You know, what a joke. Yet government after government props up this failing system. Actually, we all prop it up. We accept it when governments like the ACT talks about a human rights prison, one in which women will now legally be strip searched, legally be sexually assaulted by the state. We need to challenge this, to rattle the cage and to see who is actually in the cage, so we know when we take the challenge to them what we're talking about. We need to make the system transparent so that prison is no longer a subconscious part of the landscape in our minds, and we need to have solidarity about abolition. That has to be our starting point as a community. Now, I'm not saying that, because, you know, usually what people jump, and this is the media's fault again, you know, what about the rapists and murderers? Well, yes, people will hurt other people. That's the society we have at the moment. And I'm not saying that those people don't need to be removed so harm isn't inflicted on others, but not in a prison system when there's abuse happens. People get more angry, more violent, more abused, and they're released. They're going to be worse, not any better. We've actually got to address the underlying issues as to what we've perpetrated against people in our own communities so that their behaviours are such where they're being violent to others. And if, you know, if we think it's impossible and that it can't be achieved, you know, we need to think about, you know, centuries ago, the abolition of slavery. And Angela Davis in the US actually talks about this beautifully. You know, people had the same things. If they abolished slavery back there, the blacks are going to run riot. Never did. They're people. If you treat people with respect and dignity, they will treat you back with respect and dignity. It's so fundamental. By locking them up in cages, by strip searching them because they had contact with their children, hugged their children, kissed their children, cuddled their mother, cuddled their father, kissed and hugged their brother. Well, you know, that's unjust. People will get angry. You know, I think we've got to, if we took a different tact, what if we provided everyone with enough resources, economic, social resources, so that every child could truly have an equal chance of prospering. And when I talk about equal, I'm talking about equity, so it actually becomes a level playing field. And if we provide a good base level of care for everyone and a safety net that truly did stop people, particularly children, from falling through the cracks and into the bars, and that every child had access to high-quality education and was supported to access it and to access employment opportunities and a decent standard of living. You know, so many people in prison can't read and write. You know, and what we do, we see legislative change to criminalise parents now if children don't go to school and get educated. We never, you know, we've got to be challenging the systems, not the individuals. What if every instance of child abuse or potential abuse was caught and stopped before it flowered into a monster? You know, it's easy for governments to wax lyrical about these issues. The reality is that the end result of child abuse in our communities are filling up our prisons. You know, I could suggest to you one alternative to the present system, and there's not just one when we think outside the bars, and it would be immediately to empty the prisons of women and men serving time for drug-related offences, which could be legislated to be health issues, fraud offences because they're poverty-related, and those who are mentally unwell and those who are in prison for homelessness and colliding with the police. So many women, you know, in there are for non-violent offences. They do not need to be there, and we as a community do not need them to be there. Their children don't need them to be there, and their families don't need them to be there. So I invite you today to join me in feeling the pointy end of this debate, to consider a world in which not only prisons but poverty and prejudice and deprivation and violence and racism are abolished, and to forget about change, forget about reform, but take action to achieve abolition. To have a world in which all people experience freedom from want as a basic human right. A world, in fact, in which these two words, human rights, mean something to everyone. Thank you.